Hey, everybody. I'm Lee McCormick. Welcome to Tramps Like Us, a Bruce Springsteen podcast, episode 121. Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey, album review, side one. Two good friends are joining me today. Brian Jacobs and BJ Cramp are back, this time to discuss Mr. Springsteen's debut album, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey. Thanks for listening or downloading the show from the website trampslikeuspod.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you found it. Stay in touch and updated at our Facebook group page, Tramps Like Us, a Bruce Springsteen podcast. We've reviewed almost all of Springsteen's albums on the podcast, but a few still remain, including his very first. I'm excited to dig into this one with the fellas. I enjoy doing these album reviews, doing some research, doing some concentrated listening. I usually end up digging it more, and this was indeed the case with this album. I hope you can dig it too. Let's go back to where it all began, back to 1972, 1973, back to Asbury Park, New Jersey.
I'd like to introduce my band. Take it, boys.
Hey, is that spontaneous? When are we on the air?
Are we on the radio or are you guys
fooling? There you are.
We're on the radio now?
From high atop.
Are we on the radio now?
From high atop Alpha Recording Studios in Richmond, Virginia. The band is called Bruce Springsteen. I think are we on the air? Are we finally on the air? As usual, no response. Why don't you just start?
Okay, Clarence, let me hear you.
To Richmond, Bruce. Why don't you? There are some people here I don't think many people know. Why don't you introduce your band?
All right. On the accordion on that number, it's Principal Say, County, Little Mr. Maestro himself, Danny Federici.
Welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
Hey!
On the tuba on that number, was man that has masters in bassology, doctorate in general all-around funkiness, Long Branch, New Jersey, funky chicken, Mr. Guy T. Talon on the tuba.
Garrett.
Yeah! And on the saxophone, a duke of the king, soul man, like Larry Joe Chu, don't be two snowflakes, but they don't mess around, Mr. Clarence Clemens.
Clarence.
Yay!
Well, nice sax. Well, what do you want to play?
Well, I don't know. Let me see. Okay. Let's try Buster. All right.
Four.
trust men who walk with canes. Drink yes and you'll grow wings on your feet. Mark we Mary, John Fontaine, advertiser on a downtown train. Christmas crying, Boston came, she's in love again.
BJ Cramp, how's it going, eh?
Hey, Lee McCormick.
And Brian Jacobs is here. What's happening, man?
Hey, I'm good. Hoping you guys are too.
Good to have you guys on the show to do a little album review here of Bruce Springsteen's debut album, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey. I'm trying to kind of wrap up all these album reviews. I only got a few more albums left to do this year, I guess, on the podcast, and we will have reviewed every one of Springsteen's records. So like most of the good ones are gone, but we got this debut one left to do. Still haven't done Nebraska. I think maybe I'll do like a 40th anniversary episode maybe in the fall there. That's when that record came out. But I guess before we start about the record, we should kind of talk about where Springsteen was at this period in his life, right? Debut album, it's a big move for him, right? Going into the professional recording career here. We're looking at the early 70s, right? Bruce was at a crossroads with his career in regards to, you know, he had so many years of bar bands and playing in cover bands and doing that stuff, right? He'd done Steel Mill, kind of getting into that hard rock, kind of psychedelic stuff almost from the end of the 60s, early 70s there. He had a trip to California, right? He's expanding his musical ideas. And after that trip to California, coming back to New Jersey, he kind of changes his musical direction, right? He wants to become a solo artist now. He doesn't want to be a band guy. He wants to take everything on his shoulders. He wants it to be the Bruce Springsteen Band. He puts a couple of variations of the Bruce Springsteen Band together, right, until he kind of just decides to strip it all down and start writing solo acoustically, just himself and a guitar, right? He kind of breaks up the band that he was working with, and he's just going to be focused on solo for a while, focus on songwriting. And it's around this time when he meets Mike Appel, right? Mike Appel was a music publisher for Laurel Canyon Productions was his company, right? Springsteen played, I think, It's Hard to Be a Saint in the City. I think that was the first song he played for him. And Mike Appel was like, wow, this guy just kind of showed up on my doorstep, and here's this, he's kind of going to run with it, right? He's going to kind of quit his day job, and he's going to work for Springsteen, become his manager, and put it all together. You know, the Springsteen thinking about the independence of a solo artist was important to him, right? That's why he wanted to be a singer-songwriter kind of guy, write these songs. Begins to write the songs that would show up on this first album, right? He's living in this apartment in New Jersey, and it's above a beauty salon, right? So there's inspiration there. He said there's a piano there that his aunt had given him in this beauty salon. So he's writing these songs on piano. He's got an acoustic guitar. A lot of these songs and lyrics on this first album were really written, you know, absorbing the scenery where he's living, right? This eclectic scene down on the Jersey Shore. The other thing to consider, too, is that this was the first album and the only album where he wrote the lyrics first. Right, all the words came, and then he matched that with music, which is a technique that he didn't revisit afterwards. Right, you would write the lyrics, and then he would grab a guitar or sit at the piano, and then try and set the music to the inner rhythms of the lyrics. These kind of, shape the music to the lyrics rather than the opposite way, which I think he moved towards after this album. Right, so that's kind of interesting. You know, that change in his writing style, you know, from the lyrical sense to more of a music thing, I think came after the album was released and he was compared to Dylan, right? The next Dylan, and that kind of songwriting style of that era, right? James Taylor, Cat Stevens, Loudon Wainwright, John Prine, all these kind of guys. And he didn't want to be lumped into that kind of thing, right? So he wanted to kind of write more from a band music standpoint rather than, you know, lyrics, singer-songwriter stuff. He gets signed to Columbia Records, right? Mike Appel pushes him towards this audition for John Hammond, right? The guy that signed Bob Dylan with Columbia Records. And, you know, Springsteen does this audition, goes to John Hammond's office, plays a couple songs for him. They love it. They sign him right away, right? And the very next day, he goes into the studio and he cuts 12 demos, right? Solo acoustic demos. Most of these songs that would have show up on this first album and some other things too, right? And a lot of these demos appeared on the Tracks box set. Right, so you hear the demo version of Growing Up, And I think Mary Queen of Arkansas is on there, maybe a few more, but they're from this demo recording session that happened the day after he was signed with Columbia. Right? Essentially, Springsteen was signed as a singer-songwriter kind of guy based on that audition, right? The next Bob Dylan, right? That stuff was popular. This is how kind of John Hammond wanted to market Springsteen on Columbia Records, right? And as well as Michael Pell was big on board with this kind of style, this of Springsteen. But Springsteen wanted to kind of have a rock band as well, right? He just had, you know, 10 years of bar band experience. He was marketing himself as a singer-songwriter behind these strong songs that he'd written. But, you know, in his back pocket is this, you know, extremely professional bar band, this guy that can lead a band better than anyone else, right? So, and John Hammond, Clive Davis, Michael Pell, they didn't know that he could do this, right? So he wanted to bring some of that into his music. So instead of cutting, you know, a purely solo acoustic album, the compromise was made that they would do five acoustic songs and five band songs. Now, there were three songs on this first version of the album that he turned into Columbia. There was a song called Jazz Musician, a song called Arabian Nights. There was one called Visitation at Fort Horn, was it?
Fort Horn.
So those songs didn't make it to the record because the version that they turned in to Clive Davis was sent back, right? Clive Davis, you know, put a return to sender stamp on it, right? Return to sender. Right? He didn't hear a hit, right? So he sent it back to Springsteen and Mike Appel, and he's like, you guys got to write a hit, man. Like, I don't know, I don't hear a hit single, right? I need a hit. So Springsteen went, like, the very next day, he went to work, and he wrote Blinded by the Light and Spirit in the Night, right? Those two songs based on Clive Davis wanting a hit. It's pretty fantastic that, you know, if it wasn't for Clive Davis, those two standout songs on this record probably wouldn't be there. And who knows where the career would have gone, right? Kind of that thing where these decisions that are made can, you know, impact a career, you know, immensely one way or the other. So the album technically was produced by Mike Appel and Jim Kretikos, who was, you know, Springsteen's manager. Jim Kretikos was the other partner in Laurel Canyon Productions, right? So they get producer credits on this record. The album was recorded June 1972, mostly, and then Blinded by the Light and Spirit in the Night, those two kind of hit singles that were written afterwards, were recorded in both, I think, on September 11th, 72. With a couple of overdub sessions in October and July. But most of the record recorded in June and September 72 at this kind of low-budget studio called 914 Sound Studios. 914, I think, is the area code there in New York. But this is like a low-budget studio. This is the studio where Born to Run, the song, was recorded, right? He spent like a year at this studio recording that song before moving to a record plant. You know, they were trying to save money, right? Mike Appel was trying to save money on the budget. They got from Columbia $40,000 to make the record. That was the budget, but they made it for $11,000. Basically, overall, it's very eclectic sounding, right? It's like 60s folk music, very Dylan-esque songwriting, mixed with pop melodies. Like, that's the one thing that I think that separates, you know, Springsteen from Dylan is, you know, Springsteen can write a better pop melody than Dylan can, I think. Detailed and humorous lyrics, right? You know, as low as, what's that saying, like 10-cent words, like big words, right? Like really working at crafting those lyrics too, with a, you know, right down to each syllable kind of thing, right? You know, instrumentation, it's kind of the first step of the E Street Band too, right? There's a few players that will show up. Clarence plays on the two kind of hit singles. I'm kind of doing air quotes, hit singles kind of thing, right? Blinded by the Light, Spirit in the Night. Clarence showed up for those sessions. But the first sessions in June, Clarence wasn't around. So you had Gary Talent on bass. David Sanchez was on piano. Bruce played a lot of the other stuff. Another guy, Harold Wheeler, played on those hit singles, those two songs. A few kind of guest musicians here and there, but it's very much a solo record still with a couple of the E Street guys showing up, right? Like, the E Street Band hadn't been formed yet. Like, this is still Springsteen as a solo artist going forward, right? Interesting thing, too, is that not very much electric guitar on this record. I think there's only the one song, right? Is it Blinded by the Light? That's the only song that has electric guitar. The rest is pretty much Bruce playing like a Martin D28 acoustic guitar, right?
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and like, what guitar did he have on Blinded by the Light? I don't think he had the Tele yet, right? It's probably maybe that gold top Les Paul. It doesn't sound like a Les Paul on that track, but
no, it doesn't.
Yeah, I don't know what he, like, there's a lead guitar track on that, and like a rhythm track and an acoustic guitar. We're getting ahead of ourselves, but
yeah, well, I like it. I do. I usually don't think the process of writing the words first and then make and then putting it to music, usually that isn't the best that doesn't result in the best songs, especially melodically. I mean, plenty of times I'm sure it's worked out great, but you know, I would support matching words to melody as opposed to trying to, especially when you're writing this many words. I mean, yeah, that's the thing that stands out more than anything else on this record is a lot of words and a lot of abstract, obtuse, a lot of wordplay that I don't think necessarily really means anything. A lot of words that are just there, but what is he trying to say? It's a weird, this, you know, he didn't, like, if you look at Born to Run, a lot of words, but they make sense. You understand what he's saying. Whereas there's a lot of moments on this album where it's like he just strung these words together because they sounded cool and it was fun, but does it really mean anything at all? I don't know. And it's hard to connect to just a random barrage of words that you don't even know what it means. It's hard to connect to that, to really get much out of that. As it's entertaining, but you know, so much about Springsteen's songs later are emotional, and about, you know, you connect to it, you know what I mean. And a lot of the songs on here, I think, would have benefited from more straightforward, you know, lyrics where you could get invested. There's more of an emotional connection to the song than what you get here, because the words are so kind of sometimes almost random, which I can appreciate certain aspects of that, but I think it also detracts in the end from the effect that some of the songs have, especially certain ones. But the idea that, I mean, how calculated do you think it was? He had been, you know, he'd been hammering it out in the bars for years. Obviously, he knows he has what it takes to make a career out of this. Everyone around him knows that he's a star, but he just hasn't been able to make it happen. So then he kind of transforms himself into this singer-songwriter guy, even though as soon as he gets the record deal, he's like, well, let's bring the band back. And then everybody around him is like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
We thought you were the singer-songwriter guy, you know? But it worked. It got him the record deal and everything. But I wonder do you think that was his plan? Do you think he's like, I'll reinvent myself like this and see if this works? You know what I mean? But then as soon as he has the deal, he's like, all right, I want to do a band though. And then Mike Appel and Clive Davis and everybody are like, yeah, but we didn't sign a band. But of course they realize eventually, that yes, he does need a band, but they don't know that and also if it's hard to, we weren't around, well, you know, we weren't around in 1972 when they signed them or whatever, to understand the zeitgeist of the time and, you know, where it looked like things were going in the industry maybe. And so it was a different time where that the kind of thing he was doing on this record, maybe it looked like this is the kind of thing we want at the record label to, for the charts or whatever. And it didn't really pan out. You know, music was moving in a different, away from kind of that Dylan thing, I guess. And Springsteen adapted, but it's really it's a weird album. He reinvented himself numerous times in his career. And this, it's weird that his first album was actually a reinvention of himself.
That's true.
You know?
Right. So,
I agree with all you said there, BJ, and I think it was his first step to, you know, taking control of his art. You know, I have a quote written down here. He said, "The independence of a solo artist was very important to me." So he wanted to do this to be able to take control. You know, I want to be a solo artist, not a band. I need to be the lead guy. I want to work on my songs. And this is kind of his first attempt at working on semi-autobiographical lyrics, creating characters. Right, a lot of these songs, you'll read that one verse, and you'll be like, oh, that's definitely about him. But then it'll go off in another area, right? Like, so the one verse is about him, but the other half of it is not, right? So I think he really refined that when you get into, like, Born to Run, Darkness, The River. He's really able to say a lot with, you know, three or four quick verses, where here he's using seven or eight verses and all these words and, you know, like I said, 10-cent words, and he's able to, he was able to learn how to write songs and really hit his target audience rather than kind of singing over their heads, right?
Yeah, a lot of this is kind of a rough draft,
right?
For what he would do, and like, yeah, refine is a perfect word, and simplify, and but also, you know, he was doing these kind of songs here, but I think in a lot of ways it was an experiment, or he's trying to figure things out. Where, you know, before this, when he was with Dr. Zoom and the Sonic Boom and whatever, you know, he wasn't doing anything even resembling this, really, I don't think. And like you said, Steel Mill were like a heavy, heavy band. This is just another version of Bruce Springsteen that they got here, where all, you know, the guys who, this was the first Bruce Springsteen they saw in the industry, they didn't understand that, I guess, probably.
Right.
They didn't know the performer that they had on their hands.
Yeah.
Brian, what are your general thoughts on the record, and when was the first time you heard it and bought the album?
Well, BJ, you tell us when was the first time you heard it. I don't think we heard that from you, and then I'll jump in.
Yeah, that's a lot of times that's a hard question for me to answer, because I was just collecting and listening to everything I could get my hands on for a number of years there, and so I don't really, I think the first time I heard it was probably when I bought the record for like a buck, when I was buying every other record I could get my hands on, in the early 90s. So I don't really remember anything specific about it, or even what order I heard the Springsteen records or anything like that. But it was just one of the things I exposed myself to at that time, when I was just, you know, discovering lots and lots of stuff all in a crammed into a few years there, especially my college years. So
did you think it was so weird the first time you heard it?
Yeah, probably. I mean, of course I knew Blinded by the Light, because Milwaukee Radio just played that Manfred Mann version constantly. And also For You, they played their version of that constantly. So I'm sure it was weird to hear the originals of those, having had the other versions crammed down my throat my whole life by Milwaukee Radio. I don't know if the radio played those songs in you guys' markets, but in Milwaukee, those songs were on constantly. It was crazy how much they played those Manfred Mann versions of those songs.
Yeah, I mean, I was 7 when Blinded by the Light was a hit, you know, and I mean, that was, you know, I knew that years before I heard Bruce's version. And
yeah, exactly.
And obviously the only similarity in the two songs is the lyrics.
Yeah, right.
It's a complete rewrite.
Yeah,
it's pretty crazy. Well, I think I've told this story before, I'm not sure. I'm the youngest of 4. My oldest brother, he's 7 years older than me. He became a Springsteen fan in high school, so I was still in grade school. I bought Born to Run around the time I was in 5th grade, and that was about 79. Makes me sound really old at this point. And then he got those other albums up to that point, and they were playing all the time in the house. So I would have heard this album probably, you know, no later than being in, I don't know, maybe like 6th grade, you know, like around 1980, 81, something like that. I would have known this album pretty well by then. You know, everything up to The River got played in the house a lot. So I was a kid when I got into Springsteen, and then I became a much bigger fan of Bruce than my brother ever did, even though he's always loved him. But I never, being a kid hearing this, you know, you're not, at least I wasn't, you know, judging it. It's not like, oh, this is so much weirder than Born to Run or whatever. You know, it's just another album, and you're like kind of trying to soak it in as a kid. You know, what do all these words mean, you know?
Right.
But, you know, with hindsight and really looking at this, in kind of a broad sense, it is a real, you know, it's certainly one of the unique albums in his catalog when you compare it to what came after. I mean, even the second album after this is pretty different, you know? And this is the only album with that kind of crazy wordplay, you know, a lot of just seemingly stream of consciousness, right? And I was reading through some of the lyrics over the last week, and it's so much of it is just head scratching, you know. I don't like you were saying, BJ, I don't think, you know, didn't Bruce say in the Unplugged special, when he's talking about Blinded by the Light, that, you know, as he was writing it, what didn't he say something like his rhyming dictionary was on fire or something like that?
Yeah.
You know, it's a great album. It's an album I've always loved. It's not quite a top five for me, but I do love it. But, you know, that kind of innocence of sorts that is so evident on this album is really fantastic. It's a unique sound, and, you know, there's a lot of exuberance, and I think it's a great record. It is a little strange, though, when you look at the rest of his body of work and you come back to this, and it's certainly a lot more stripped down than any other band album, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I probably heard this full record probably mid-90s for the first time. You know, I only had, like, I definitely didn't have this album in my collection in the 80s. You know, I had the 75-85 live box set filled in a lot of those Springsteen albums for a long time because I was satisfied. I'm like, oh, I got all these Springsteen songs on this five record set, right? So I don't really need to go back into the catalog. You know, I was still, you know, an early teenager. I didn't have the funds back then, right? And off that record, I think only Spirit in the Night is the only song off this album that's on that live set, right? So I didn't even know the other eight songs on the album until the mid-90s when I got it on CD. There's a period in the 90s there where I was just buying everything on CD, right? Like 80% of my part-time job paycheck went to CDs, right? Every 2 weeks I would go down to the record store, and I had a good buddy who worked for the record store, so I would get cost on a lot of these titles, right? My favorite artist, I was just filling in all these back catalogs and getting all these records. So at some point I got this album, and, you know, I was immediately taken with a few songs off the record. You know, definitely Blinded by the Light. I knew that Manfred Mann version for the longest time. They played it all the time up here to BJ on the radio. And I love that version. Yeah. That's a great song. You know, in the last, you know, 20 years, I probably got it on vinyl, you know, filling in all my vinyl collection too for Springsteen. And, yeah, like, it's probably in my lower half of favorite Springsteen albums. But, you know, there's a few songs I really dig on this album. And once again, after doing these kind of album review, analyzing this stuff for this podcast, I've come to appreciate this album a little bit more, studying it like this, right?
It's a beautiful thing.
It is. It's good when it works out like that, you know? So,
and real quick, Lee, there are a third of this album appears on the live box.
Really? What did I forget?
Growing Up.
Oh, yeah, Spirit. Growing Up, of course, Growing Up.
Spirit,
yeah.
In the Night and Saint in the City.
Saint in the City, right? Okay, I was wrong there. I should have had Growing Up, yeah, for sure, too. All right, I stand corrected. Let's just talk a little bit about the album cover, right? BJ, I know you're not a fan of Springsteen album covers, and I agree he doesn't have the best album covers when you look at his, you know, catalog. But this one's pretty good, right? I dig this one. This one is...
Yeah, this is a good one.
Yeah.
It's not a close-up of his face.
Yeah, and, you know, the title of the album and the cover was, you know, specifically chosen by Bruce to distance himself from being touted as this... this New York City singer-songwriter kind of guy, right? Which is what he was being, you know, heralded as by Mike Appel and Columbia. They wanted this kind of New York singer-songwriter vibe, right? And he was just like, no, man, I'm an artist from New Jersey, and I'm proud of my roots, right? So he was walking down the boardwalk there, and he saw this postcard, and he was just like, yeah, that greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey. That would be a cool title for the album and possibly an album cover, right? So he commissioned this guy. What was his name? Do I have his name here? The cover was designed by John Berg. Did my notes say that right? John Berg, I think that's his name. So he created this cover based on the postcard, right? We got on the back, we have lyrics on the back cover. And we talk about, you know, all the words in this song. You know, if you just glance at it, it looks like, oh, all the lyrics are on the back cover. But it's actually lyrics for only the first side, right? Because there's so many fucking words in every song. So that's a gatefold. So you open the record up and there's more lyrics on the inside as well as kind of the opposite panel of the front cover. You see the back of the postcard and it has the musician credits and the kind of all that, the other producing credits and all that stuff on there too, right?
Yeah, it is a great and classic album cover as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it is. It's really
pretty
good.
Iconic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you would have needed a magnifying glass if they put all the lyrics on the back, you know?
Yeah, for sure. All right, so let's get into this record. Let's do a track by track. So the album was released January 5th, 1973, right? Released, you know, right after Christmas to kick off the year 1973, right? Columbia Records. And the first track was recorded. This is one of those songs that Clive Davis requested. You got to go back, write me a hit single, right? So this song was recorded September 11th, 1972. Musicians on this track are Bruce Springsteen on vocals, acoustic guitar, electric guitar, Bruce on bass as well on this track. We got Harold Wheeler on piano, Clarence Clemons on saxophone and background vocals. We got Vinnie Mad Dog Lopez on drums, and an unidentified musician playing some organ and tambourine on here. This is Blinded by the Light.
Madman drummers, bombers, and Indians in the summer with a teenage diplomat. In the dumps with the mumps as the adolescent pumps his way into his hat. With a boulder on my shoulder, feeling kinda older, I trip the merry-go-round. With this very unpleasing sneezing and wheezing, the Calliope crashed to the ground. Some old hot head shot was heading for a hot spot, snapping his fingers, clapping his hands. In some flesh bomb mascot was tied to a lover's knot with a whatnot in her hand. And now young Scott with a slingshot finally found a tender spot and throws his lover in the sand. And some bloodshot forget-me-not whisper daddies with an earshot, save the buckshot, turn up the band.
I think it's one of the great opening tracks of anybody's album ever. You know, you could go back to, you know, I Saw Her Standing There from the Beatles, or, you know, any great first track, you know, it's just a tremendous song. There's so much exuberance in the vocal. He absolutely, his vocal is so great. And I don't know how he had the breath to spit all those words out. You know, he's not exactly singing low, you know, there's an effort to that vocal, you know. It's such a great song, and Clarence is obviously key to it. You know, it's, if you think about it, the key ingredient, you know, if you said to a bunch of random people, what's one of the key parts of Springsteen's music, they would say the saxophone. And Clarence is there from the very beginning, and he plays throughout the song. So you kind of get a little bit of the E Street Band template right off the bat, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know if this song means anything, right? It's a whole lot of fun. There's probably some autobiographical bits in it. I always find it fun to sing along with, you know, but I'm out of breath about halfway through. yeah, it's a great one. I don't want to beat it to death. It's just a great one.
Yeah, you were mentioning some autobiographical stuff there. I think he said that the first verse is pretty much, you know, his life, and then it just goes off to the stratosphere after that, right? Like, so that line, Madman Drummers, that's Mad Dog Vinny Lopez, right? There's a Teenage Diplomat, that's himself, right? They're talking about Indians in the Summer, that was like his Little League baseball team, stuff like that, right? So he's using these kind of descriptive words to, you know, create this image, and then it kind of just goes off from there, right? And, you know, we mentioned the rhyming dictionary before. Definitely some great inner rhyme lines on here, right? So an inner rhyme line is like even like that first verse, right? Madman, drummers, bummers, you know, drummers and bummers, rhyming those together with summer kind of thing. Even though those are not really the key words that need to rhyme, like every kind of every other line usually rhymes in a song kind of thing, right? But inner rhyme lines are a way to kind of, you know, just string different words together to kind of create that other kind of rhythmic momentum in a song. When I went to Camp Copperhead, Steve Earle kept talking about inner rhyme lines all the time, right? So, you know, I love that stuff. This was the first single. It was edited down to 3:58. I think the version on the record is like 5 minutes. And it didn't chart, right? Released as his first single, didn't even crack the top 100.
Wow.
Right? Even though the Manfred Mann version that we mentioned went to number one in February 77. And still, that's Bruce's only number one song that he's written kind of thing, right?
That's crazy.
Yeah, Dancing in the Dark should have been a number one hit if it wasn't for When Doves Cry, though. But, you know, Dancing in the Dark should have been number one there, summer of 84.
You know, let me jump in there real quick. I've always wondered, you know, I know that Mike Appel had such a restrictive contract on him, and I think he owned half of his publishing, if I'm not mistaken. But I don't know that I ever read anything about, like, the money that he did or didn't make out of having a number one single, you know, just a few years after his recording career, you know, get started. So, you know,
yeah, he's right.
Still very much in the spotlight of Born to Run in February, or well, no, it was February 77. So yeah. Born to Run's already like a year and a half old,
right?
At that point. But, you know, he famously said he didn't have any money in the bank until Hungry Heart came out, you know, a few years later. So I wonder what that did for him financially. And I have no idea. I'm wondering out loud. I don't know if you guys know anything about that.
I never really thought about that, but yeah, it's interesting.
I don't know. And that was, you know, 77. That was the year he kind of took off, and he was kind of in all those legal battles with Mike Appel. So I wonder if that was kind of considered during those battles.
Maybe that's part of what pissed him off.
Yeah.
Right.
Mike Appel's getting all this money.
Mike Appel is getting all the money from Man for Man. Yeah. I never thought about that.
Yeah. But this track, like you said, Brian, sounds like the E Street Band. Like, musically, we're getting there a little bit, even though the rest of the album doesn't really sound like the E Street Band. But we got Clarence there. We got that kind of rock and soul vibe with the rhythm of the guitar. Some of these lyrics are so great, like the rhyme lines, right? You know, it was kidnapped, handicap, caught the clap from some mouse trap that he bought. All that stuff is so great, right? Obviously, the line, cut loose like a deuce, referring to like a hot rod deuce coupe, which was misinterpreted as revved up like a douche, the Manfred Mann version. Yeah, there's that whole bit in Storytellers that you mentioned, Brian, where he goes through lyrically analyzing this song, which is cool. I don't know if I'll drop a bit in here, but if you want to go back, I did a whole episode on that Storytellers episode. I think it's episode 69, where he dissects the lyrics in here, and it's pretty funny because he even says himself that he was just kind of, you know, just doing this as a kind of a rhyming exercise kind of thing, right? And, you know, the theme of the song is still there, right? He's setting out to conquer New York City with his guitar in hand kind of thing, right? And he wants to get blinded by the light, right? He wants to go to places he's never been before. He wants to be on that stage with the lights shining down on him, right? And obviously that great last line brings it all together where he says, you know, Mama always told me not to look into the sights of the sun, but Mama, that's where the fun is, right? And it just kind of fades out, so I dig that.
Yeah, it kind of seems like a stunt, right? It's like, how many words can I fit in here? And what's really amazing about it is it's still melodic. I mean, it can't be easy to have this many words and have a melody that works, but it does work. Like, you know, this song has more than 500 words, which is, that's 200 more words than Born to Run. And just for comparison, Hungry Heart has less than 100 words, right? So 500 words crammed into a song is completely insane. Maybe, probably the most. Well, maybe Dylan beat him on some 10-minute song or something on Blonde on Blonde or something. But I mean, that it's it's got to be purposeful, like to just say, you know, I'm gonna just, this song's gonna be insane, right? I mean, it's kind of seems like I said, it's got to be almost purposeful to do that, like kind of a stunt, but it definitely works. That's one thing about this album is I think the production is really good. Everything, it sounds good. And a song like this, he completely pulls it off, which, I mean, if you handed somebody these lyrics and said, turn this into a song, I don't think most people could churn out something that would really work, that would have a melody or even a structure. So, it's very impressive, and it's a very fun song. It's just this insane barrage of imagery, but he pulled it off. If he was trying to pull something off, which it seems like he was, he did. And it's also hilarious that Clive Davis asks for a hit and you write a song with 500 words.
Yeah, he explodes. I love that stuff. Yeah. Like, here, write me a hit song. So he like explodes with one of his most like expansive lyrically descriptive songs.
I would like to see
ever.
The look on Clive Davis's face hearing this for the first time.
Hey Lee, I got a quick question for you. If you're done there, Bri.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Lee, talk about this song and some of the songs in general when it comes to like the groove of the band, because I know Vinnie Mad Dog was considered kind of a sloppy drummer. I mean, I think for those first two albums, he did his job well. He's like a little bit of a wild card on the Skins, right? But when I was listening to this in the last week or so, you know, when the band kicks in on this song, I remember thinking to myself, and I hadn't really thought about it before because I've heard these songs so many times over the years, and I thought to myself, wow, this is thinking about it, this is kind of a little sloppy, you know? Like, talk about your thoughts as far as like the band dynamic on the album.
Definitely the tightness of the E Street Band that we would get in the late 70s is not here at all, right? This is a loose band, and you got to think of where he's coming from too. Like I said, Steel Mill, and he had the Bruce Springsteen Band, which was like a 14-piece band with like a, you know, violin player and all that stuff, right? And you know, the late 60s, early 70s, all that kind of psychedelic rock and experimental music, and he's kind of going through that, right? And working on the Jersey Shore and all those bands, and you know, this is what bands sounded like in the early 70s, right? Van Morrison influences and that kind of stuff, right? And he wouldn't get that kind of tight Rolling Stones kind of rock stuff until the late 70s. So when he brings the band in on this album for four or five songs, you get that kind of mix, right? And also the fact that he's not really working with a band. He's just bringing in players for this, right? This isn't a touring band that's recording these songs. This is Bruce with a handful of songs that he's written, and he's showing the parts to the guys in the studio, and they're learning them, and they're playing it that way, right? Springsteen's even on bass on this song, right? And there's some pretty good bass playing on by Bruce on this song too, right? So, you know, that's a big factor too. Whenever you get, you know, a non-band recording, you're going to get some sloppiness, some looseness, hopefully, right? Especially the players you're choosing too, right? Like, you're bringing Vinny Mad Dog Lopez in on the drums. You're not bringing in, like, a tight session guy. These aren't session musicians, right? These are street musicians. With the exception of maybe David Sanchez and some of the other ringers that are brought in here, you know.
Another thing I read is that this is John Landau heard this song on the radio, and this was his first, when John Landau heard this, that's when he first got interested in Bruce Springsteen. So this song kind of kicks off that, what, you know, what's going to happen with Landau down the road is what I read.
Right, right.
Interesting.
So what was that one about? You know, that was, well, I always say that, that's a song that explains why I never did any drugs. I don't think I could have stood it. My mind was already reeling, but I'll give it to you a little bit by bit. All right. Madman Drummers, Bummers, and Indians in the Summer. Mad Dog Vincent Lopez, drummer in the E Street Band. He was always getting in shit. And Indians in the Summer. Well, the Indians was my little league team when I was a kid. So, but it was also kind of cowboys and Indians in the woods, but Indians in the Summer, the Teenage Diplomat, well, that's me. All right. In the dumps with the mumps, I was diseased. As the adolescent pumps his way into his hat, self-explanatory. With a boulder on my shoulder, I've always felt something big pressing down my whole life. Feeling kind of older, I tripped a merry-go-round. That's where I was living. That was the boardwalk. And with this very unpleasing sneezing and wheezing, Calliope crashed to the ground. That was, I seek chaos and disruption, I suppose. Some all hot half shots heading for the hot spot, snapping his fingers, clapping his hands. That's me. Some flesh plot. Is that right? Am I missing that? Scott, young Scott, is that, are we missing something? Hi, that's what. Then, fingers clapping his hands. All right, I'm going to go with it. All right. Some flesh pot mascot was tied into a lover's knot with a whatnot in her hand. That was me and a friend. All right. Now, young Scott with a slingshot finally found a tender spot. We always looking for life's tender spots. You know, that's where, you know, that's where the love is, you know. Throws his lover in the sand. And some bloodshot forget-me-not whispers daddy's within earshot. I was always very unpopular with my girlfriend's parents. Save the buckshot, I'll turn up the band, but I could not be defeated, you see. Then we got the chorus. I was blinded by the light. That kind of says it all. You know, that's what I was looking for. Cut loose like a deuce, another runner in the night. This is an interesting line. Because this song is my only number one song. I never had another number one song except this one, and it wasn't done by me. It was done by Manfred Mann, which I appreciate. But they changed this line. My line says, cut loose like a deuce. And theirs said, cut loose like a douche. I have a feeling that is why the song skyrocketed to number one. But it's one of those, you know, that word, you know, and deuce was like little deuce coupe, as in two-seater hot rod. Douche, of course, is a feminine hygienic procedure. So they're different. And, what can I say? You know, the public spoke and they were right, you know. So, all right, let me carry on. Brimstone, baritone, anticyclone, rolling stone, preacher from the east. Says dethrone, the dictaphone, hit it in its funny bones. Gotta be funny. Everything was funny. It's where they expect at least. New moon, chaperone, standing in the corner all alone, watching the young girls dance. I guess that was the YMCA when they had the guys sitting in the corner with the flashlight, and if you moved in for a quick grind, they'd hit you with the spotlight. Some fresh zone moonstone was messing with his frozen zone. That was if you were in the stands. The YMCA had a little basketball court in the stands. In the far corner of the stands, there was always something slightly shady going on, you know. To remind him of the feeling of romance, very necessary. Blinded by the light, there comes a chorus. Some silicone sister with her manager's Mr. Possibly the first reference to female breast enhancement in popular music. So I was ahead of my game on that. Said I'll turn you on, Sonny, to something strong if you play that song with the funky break, which is my business. Go-kart Mozart, checking out the weather chart, see if it was safe to go outside. A little early Pearly came by in her curly whirly and asked me if I needed a ride. That's self-explanatory. Some hazard from Harvard was skunked on beer. Well, that was sort of the day. This was 1972, which was just still the 60s in New Jersey, and it was kind of this whole campus radical thing, and so that found its way in. Scotland Yard was trying hard. The FBI sent some dude with a calling card. The undercover agent said, do what you like, but don't do it here. Jumped up, turned around, spit in the air, fell on the ground. Asked him which was the way back home. Said, take a right at the light, keep going straight until night. And then, boys, you're on your own, which I was. Is that all clear? By now, the rhyming dictionary is in flames. It's getting, it's hot in my hand, man. I'm just burning up. Zanzibar shooting star was riding a sidecar, humming a lunar tune. Avatar said, blow the bar. Once again, Campus Radicals, first remove the cookie jar, don't blow up the money. We're going to teach those boys to laugh too soon. Some kidnapped handicap was complaining that he caught the glap, a little road experience, unfortunately, from some mousetrap he bought last night. I unsnapped his skull cap between his ears. I saw the gap and figured he'd be all right. Don't overthink the whole thing. Which I didn't do on this. Don't overthink the whole thing. So really, the best line, the line that makes the whole song. Mama always told me not to look into the sights of the sun, but mama, that's where the fun is. And that was where I wanted to go. I wanted to get blinded by the light. I wanted to do things I hadn't done and see things I hadn't seen. I was 23 years old. I wanted to create my own ridiculous language. And so it was really a young musician's tale, kind of a litany of adventures, and it was rather on the autobiographical side. Wasn't a hit, though. Maybe I should have changed that word. So.
All right, so let's go on to track two. So this was recorded in June 1972. This is Springsteen on vocals and acoustic guitar. We have David Sanchez on piano, Gary Town on the bass, Vinny Mad Dog Lopez on the drums. Growing Up.
Well, I stood stone like at midnight, suspended in my masquerade, and I combed my hair till it was just right and commanded the night brigade. I was open to pain and crushed by the rain, and I walked on a crooked crutch. I strode all along to a fallout zone, came out with my soul untouched. I hid in the cloud and wrath of the crowd. When they said sit down, I stood up.
Very autobiographical song, probably the most autobiographical song on the album, maybe in his entire career. Written in the first person, we got that trademark piano intro, and the piano figure that you hear is very Bruce and the E Street Band. You know, that sort of arpeggiated kind of chord that he's playing there, the sus chords and stuff too, right? That's a piano sound that you'll hear Springsteen work with many years to come, which makes me think, did he write this song on piano or guitar? It's hard to tell, right? Did he have an acoustic guitar, or was he writing on that piano in the in the beauty salon, right? Look, a great song about moving from, you know, childhood, adolescence, through the teen years to becoming an adult, right? Not fitting in at school, clashing with parental figures. This is one of the songs that he auditioned with for John Hammond there in Columbia. Great song, filled with all these metaphors of adolescence, right? I love those lines. When they said sit down, I stood up. You know, the need to rebel, non-conforming. You know, I broke all the rules. You know, he's starting to get into some automobile imagery too. You know, the car is used many times as a metaphor for like freedom, travel, right? And he's got that line, you know, I found the key to the universe in the engine of an old parked car. Right? That's just so amazing, right? I love it, right? We get a nice piano solo here by David Sanchez on the studio version. You know, live, Clarence would always do a great sax solo on this, right? But, you know, Clarence isn't around during this this time, right? Like I said, these sessions that were done in June, Clarence wasn't even in the band. Clarence was off playing. It was only until he was told to write two more hit singles that he brought Clarence in back in September to, you know, cut some sax. So no sax on this, but, you know, it's a great song, one of his best, I think. And always live, he would extend this song live, right? Like you said, it's on the 75-85 box, and I can't believe I forgot that, because he tells that great middle story in there about growing up and his life kind of thing, right? And, you know, especially during Springsteen on Broadway, this was the song that opened the show, right? Talking about his childhood and, you know, becoming a teenager and into an adolescent adult was this song, Growing Up. So I dig this one.
Yeah, this is very skilled songwriting. Great arrangement. The atmospheric opening just builds perfectly, and it kicks in without wasting any time. It's really beautiful. And there's plenty of words in this song, but it's much more straightforward. There's wordplay, but he's dealing in a pretty universal theme here. So definitely this is a song that people can relate to. And I think, to me, this is the most accessible song on the album. I think this was the single. This song is very melodic, very catchy, the most relatable lyrics. So to me, this seems like, of any song in the album, this seems like the most accessible one. I don't know what you guys think about that, but...
Well, Clive Davis didn't hear a single, I guess, right? This was on the
record. Yeah, right. I mean, this, yeah, this seems like a potential hit to me. And with the most mainstream kind of potential, even more than, you know, because Blinded by the Light, it's a lot of, it's weird. It's weird, mm-hmm. you know? And Spirit in the Night, too, which we'll get to later, you know, definitely has a lot of elements of a hit song, but it's also got pretty wacky lyrics. So I think this song, you know, if you look at all the elements, I think this is the most kind of the one with the most possible like mainstream appeal. But yeah. So, yeah, this is a brilliant song.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you say that, BJ, because I actually have the lyrics up to all these from Bruce's website as we're talking about them. And I never thought of it in that way. But, yeah, I think this probably would have been the most natural single. And looking at this, certainly compared to the last one, it's just three tight verses. You know, there's no bridge mm-hmm. in it. It's bang, bang, bang. It's what, three and a half minutes, something like that. And yeah, I think you're right. I think this really could have been a single. It is catchy. It's melodic. And if you think about it in the grand scheme of Bruce's story, this song is so important to his live show through the 70s. And whether or not he played this much on like the Born in the USA tour, I don't know, but certainly through the 70s, you know, it was always, you know, for the breakdown in the middle with Stories and stuff like that. But I do find it interesting that they took that, that melodic Davy Sanchez piano solo and turned that into a really exuberant Clarence solo, you know, which is so great. But yeah, a real essential song for him that, as you said, Lee, you know, to this day is important to him because it opened up all of his Broadway shows. It's a great song. It's catchy. It's super, you know, it's real exuberant, lots of energy and great imagery and stuff like that. The flag of piracy flew from my mast.
That's so good.
You know, it's a classic.
And I love how he does that little twist on the lyrics on the end of each verse, where he's like, "When they said sit down, I stood up," and then there's one, "When they said come down, I threw up," and the other one's, "They said pull down, I pulled up." It's always just doing, always just, you know, butting heads, just whatever the anti-establishment, you know, whatever they say to do, I'm going to do the opposite. And yeah, since its debut live January 30th, 1972, it's been performed over 600 times since. So
wow.
Yeah. Next track is just Springsteen alone, vocals, guitar, harmonica. What John Hammond and Mike Appel wanted the album to sound like, a whole album of these songs, right? Recorded June 1972. This is Mary Queen of Arkansas.
Mary, Queen of Arkansas, it's not too early for dreaming. The sky is grown with cloud seed song, and a bastard's love can be redeeming. Mary, my queen, your soft hug is reviving. No, you're not too late to desecrate are just rising.
Do you guys think this song is kind of sloppy on purpose? It's very, yeah, it's, it just feels like a one take to me. I like it. I like it. It's a real, it's especially listening to this in the earbuds. It's a very intimate song, but, you know, this is one where the lyrics are so obtuse that it's like, it could be so much more, have so much more impact with different lyrics, I think. I think that, at least for me, especially at this point, I wish that, you know, could you imagine a song like My City of Ruin or something if it's just these kind of lyrics that make no sense? That's a lot of kind of, I mean, is there symbolism or not? I don't know. It's very abstract. And I've been a shine boy for your acid brat and a wharf rat of your state. You know, it's like, I'm not sure what the hell he's talking about.
How old is he? We should consider his age, right? He's like 20,
He's
like 22 when he's writing these songs, right? So
it's not even necessarily a criticism, but you know, there's numerous Springsteen songs that I cannot listen to without crying, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of that has to do with the lyrics or just the intent of the vocal. But when you have lyrics that are like this, it's just never going to have that kind of impact for me because of that, I think. But I do like it. And this is definitely, just as an album, this is a good album where you just want, you just listen to the whole thing. It's one piece, you know? And so singling the songs out on a record like this, you know, that's not really the point. I think for this, it's meant to be listened to as an album. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like I said, I think My City of Ruin, which is one of my favorites, it's like, imagine if that song had these insane lyrics that made no sense. It just wouldn't be the same song, you know? So.
Yeah, I think you kind of started off with a good point there, BJ, in that, yeah, you know, the term that popped into my mind when you said it's kind of sloppy, like, I think the performance on this was certainly very intentional, and I think the word that I'm thinking of is just kind of freewheeling, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, Bruce is an artist, and I think this was the performance that just came out of him. Yeah, and I bet you're right. I bet there were a few takes of this, if many more than one, you know. I think it's a great one. I've always loved this song, and I love the build, you know, that it builds at one point in the middle and then at the end. And the bridge in this, I think, is really powerful. The big top is for dreamers, that part. This is also the first song. I mean, he talks about the circus, you know, somewhat on these early albums. And, you know, and this is the first one. And Blinded by the Light, he talks about Calliope and stuff like that. He certainly loved those images. And obviously talks about those images on the second album, too. I think that was the dreamer in him. And you know, the restless spirit in him, you know, what did he, you know, what does he sing about in Born to Run, you know, getting out of town, right? And circus folk, what do? They travel, right? I wonder if he related to that, but you know, that's kind of just an aside. I think this is a really powerful performance. I love his guitar strumming when the song gets a little manic there at the end. And his harmonica playing is very gentle. And I would, the word that's coming to mind is very considered that he overdubbed through this. I think it's a great song. I'm not sure it's most people's favorite, but... and it's not my favorite, but I think it complements the album very well. I really do.
interesting that he overdubbed that harmonica, right? He's not just playing it with it strapped around his neck like Bob Dylan or Neil Young, but he's actually playing over the verses while he's singing. He's got some harmonica
right
going on there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this was another song that was from that John Hammond audition, another song they recorded on those 12 demos the day after he was signed. And like you said, the kind of rough sloppiness to it, like it's very slow and the tempo is set by Bruce and it's very fluid because it's just him on a guitar and he doesn't have to worry about the band, right? So he can speed up, he can slow down, it's just him solo, right? So that's an interesting thing with this song. And of course the emotional vocal delivery is the main strength, I think, of this song, which is something that he is so good at. His vocals and his singing just got better with each album, and it's here right from the beginning. We get 4.5 verses on this song, no chorus. Right, and I think I get the song is about two people from two different worlds. He loves her, sometimes she loves him back, sometimes she doesn't. You know, one of the last verses, it's got that line, I don't understand how you can hold me so tight and love me so damn loose. Right, it's a story about love that cannot be fulfilled.
I saw, it might be in that giant book that we got, Lee, that giant book about the song by song. Or somewhere I saw where at some point Springsteen claimed this song was about a guy in love with a transvestite. Were you gonna say that?
Yeah, I was just gonna get to go off on my.
I don't know if I hear that.
Yeah, he confirmed live in concert that this song is about a drag queen. Played it live in Pittsburgh on May 22nd, 2014, and he says he plays the song solo acoustic. And at the end of it, he says something like. Song is about a drag queen. Check out those lyrics and you'll see what I mean, kind of thing, right? So there's that one line in there where he says, you're not man enough for me to hate or woman enough for kissing, right? So,
it's that ambiguity there, right?
Yeah.
Next song was recorded June 1972. We have Bruce on vocals, acoustic guitars. We have David Sanchez on piano. Gary Talent on the bass. Mad Dog Lopez on the drums. Does this bus stop at 82nd Street?
Hey, bus driver, keep the change. Bless your children, give them. Trust men who walk with canes. Drink this and you'll grow wings on your feet. Broadway Mary Joan Fontaine. Advertiser on a downtown train. Oh, Christmas crier busted cane. He's in love again. When dock workers' dreams mix with Panther schemes, the someday on the rodeo.
I think one of the first things you could say about this is I think this is one of the shortest songs in his catalog. I think it only clocks in about 2 minutes, and there's only really about two verses to this song. I mean, he crams the words into those 2 minutes, but you know, this is another one with kind of the same energy as Blinded by the Light, I think, you know, and it does plays a little bit with that, you know, rock and soul type of feel like Blinded by the Light does. And, you know, a ton more imagery and rhyming, imps, pimps, limp, nymphs.
Yeah. I love that. Lots of the wizard imps and sweat sock pimps. Iller stellar mongrel nymphs. Rex says she left him limp.
Yeah, this is an awesome song. It's so catchy. A lot of great chord changes in this song. And the early albums of his, you know, I feel like the song structures were just a smidge looser than they would become, you know, starting with the Darkness album. But this is another one with a lot of chord changes, and it's a great one. I love this song.
New York City vibe, of course, on this one, right? 82nd yeah. Street. Anytime you have those songs that have the numbered streets, it's like New York, right? 53rd and 3rd by the Ramones, right? There's like across 110th Street. There's a, what's the Billy Joel one? Like 52nd Street or whatever, right? That's New York. Right. That's a New York vibe, obviously, right? Street poetry, words coming before the music, right? You can tell he's working on these elaborate word and rhymes, you know, and he's able to do that as a folk artist, but not as a bar band. I think he said that, you know, he could never do a song like this in a bar because people just couldn't hear the lyrics. But, you know, in coffee houses and in this kind of folk singer-songwriter context that he's writing and recording, he can get into some of these wordy lyrics and verses, right? Semi-autobiographical, about a guy, you know, going uptown in Harlem, going to see his girl. Obviously, his father drove a bus, right? So that might have been a little bit of inspiration for him there, as well as he's kind of going to New York City to see his girlfriend, right, to do all these, you know, meetings at Columbia with Mike Appel, all these recording sessions. He's this guy coming from Asbury Park into New York City, right, and this is kind of him looking out the bus window and what's going on in the streets. Good drums by Vinny on this, catching those shots with the hi-hat and the cymbal shots, right? So, you know, Vinny sounds really good on this. On that tour, that 2012 tour where he had the horn section, I think they played this a bunch of times, and you know, it sounds really good with the horn section on this. An abrupt ending, too, right? It's like goes into this like slow retard, like right on that last verse on the lyrics, and it kind of stops on this this non-tonic chord, which is interesting.
And, yeah, it's pretty odd.
Yeah, and I love that line, too, where there's one of the last lines is the Daily News asks her for the dope, but she says, she says the dope's that there's,
that
still,
there's
hope.
Still hope.
The dope is that there's still hope, right? I dig that.
Yeah. Yeah, I love this. This is a contender for my favorite song on the album. It's just great. It's too short, practically. It's funny how this song, it's just a short burst, and it's like crammed between 2 5-minute kind of ballads.
It definitely needs a solo section, you know?
Yeah. This is a great song. So much fun. And these kind of lyrics work. It's like it's about all the weirdos on the bus, and it's about the city, insanity of the city, and yeah,
right.
Everything about this is really great. I mean, it might benefit from being so short, just because nothing about it is drawn out or anything. But
it's concise.
Yeah, I love it.
I want to mention one thing real quick. I was talking to my wife a little bit before we recorded. And I was reading her the lyrics to Mary Queen of Arkansas, and she's like, oh, that's really interesting. She said, is that the first song that he used the name Mary? And I'm like, oh, that's a good point. Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Oh, yeah, right.
and then here we are on track 4, and there's Broadway Mary. So Mary already appeared, the name Mary appears twice on side one of his first album. he likes his certain names, right?
Yeah.
He's a good Catholic boy, man. You can't get those Catholic names out of his
head. Oh, yeah, you got that right.
All right, so let's go on to the last song on side one. This was recorded in June of 1972, and then we did a little overdub in July of 72. This has Bruce Springsteen on vocals, David Sanchez on keyboards, Gary Talon on the bass, Vinny Mad Dog Lopez on drums. Special appearance by Little Steven Van Zandt on amp effects. And this is Lost in the Flood.
The ragamuffin gunner's returning home like a hungry runaway. He walks through town all alone. He must be from the fort, he hears the high school girls say. His countryside's burning with wolfmen fairies, dressed in drag for homicide. They hit and run, plead sanctuary neath the holy stone they hide. They're breaking beams and crosses with a spastic's real imperfection. Nuns run bald through Vatican halls, pregnant, pleading immaculate conception. And everybody's wrecked on Main Street from drinking unholy blood. Sticker smiles sweet as Gunner breathes deep, his ankles caked in mud. And I said, hey, Gunner, man, that's quicksand. That's quicksand, that ain't mud. Have you thrown your sense to the war? Did you lose them in the flood?
We got three verses on this, and each verse tells a different story. But it kind of comes together thematically, I think, right? The first verse is about a ragamuffin gunner returning home. I guess it's like a Vietnam vet, right? The second verse is about Jimmy the Saint. Now, it could be the same guy from the first verse, but we're not sure. There's a little ambiguity there. Who knows? But Jimmy the Saint is this guy, and he goes racing in his car on Sundays in Jersey in a Chevy stock Super 8 kind of thing. And then the third verse, we have kind of people on the street that get caught in a gunfight between cops and the whiz-bang gang. You know, those three verses, the soldier returning home with the PTSD. The second verse, we got the guy with the hot rods living free, racing cars, but, you know, eventually you're going to die in a car wreck kind of thing, right? Accidents are bound to happen. And then the third verse, where we have city kids raised amongst gang violence. So it kind of paints that picture of that kind of that sleazy New York City, Times Square in the 70s, kind of that taxi driver world. That's the kind of vision I see when I hear this song, right? The Vietnam vet returning and seeing what his world has become, what his society has become kind of thing, right? Is that line of a real highwayman's farewell. Man, that ain't oil, that's blood. Both those hot rodders, right, in the second verse. And we got more car imagery, right? Hot rodders. I love how the drums come in halfway through that second verse. Right, it's in the middle of the verse, and Vinnie Mad Dog Lopez comes in with the drums, and it kind of builds the song up. Lost in the Flood, the title, talking about being swallowed up by the darkness of your world. And I love those shots in between the verse with the piano. The Bruce starting with the vocals, very intense singing over the nice piano playing there by David. This would turn into more of a loud rocking song when he would play it live, especially in the 2000 Live in New York City record. There's a kick-ass version of this song on there with the loud guitar and everything. And notable that we should say, I mentioned Steven Van Zandt on guitar effects. The intro of the song has the piano. We hear that thunder sound effect with the guitar amp. It's a Dan Electro guitar amp, and with the reverb cranked, if you kind of drop it or if you kind of put it up on one end and tilt it back, it would make this kind of like the sound of the reverb, the spring reverb kind of echoing in the amp, right? So Steven came back in July to do an overdub on this song with that little effect, which is really cool.
I like it. It's a good, it's as a part of the album, I like it, and it's a good end to the side. I do have in my notes that the melody gets lost in the flood of syllables. it's a lot of words. It kind of gets repetitive by the end of the 5+ minutes, I think, at least for me. But it fades out very abruptly. I like it. It's definitely not one of my favorites on the album. And I think it doesn't... I guess you can understand what he's talking about on most of it, but it's still... it's just a lot of lyrics, though. But as a part of the album, it's good, and it's a good end to the first side for sure.
I think this was probably, you know, one of the earlier kind of dark songs in the realm of rock and roll that I was drawn to. You know, I always loved this one. You know, such a dark story. His vocal on it is really fantastic. I was always kind of drawn to also the fact that, Vinny's playing those big drum fills at the end. you know, as the song built to that kind of crescendo. But yeah, it does just kind of drop off there at the end, which was kind of interesting. I wonder if they struggled with an arrangement for that. Well, we could fade it out, or we could just end it, you know.
Yeah,
that's that sort of thing. But I seem to remember, you know, on that Live in New York City, I went to three of the, what were there, 10 shows on that Last Stand, I think?
Yep, 10 at Madison Square Garden.
I went to three of them. I think I went to shows 1, 3, and 5, if I remember right. And I remember my one Springsteen buddy, you're talking about, you know, what's he going to pull out for the last night? And I remember there being a rumble about it being Lost in the Flood, and that was the one. And yeah, I mean, he's played that here and there through the years since that tour, right? I did see him do it in Philly once, which was pretty awesome.
He's done it solo a piano a few times, I think, too. And
I think I saw him do it with the band at Lincoln Financial Field, if I remember correctly, on the Rising tour, I think. If I remember right, I'd have to go back and look. But I think it's a really powerful tune. I couldn't describe it better than you probably did there, Lee, as far as like the story. I think it's a real powerful one. I love that live version on the Hammersmith as well. I think that's real powerful. Yeah, it's a great one. And like you said, BJ, great side ender.
Satin shirts whisper in the air. Some storefront incarnation of Maria, she's putting on me a stare. And Bronx's best apostle stands with his hand on his own hardware. Everything stops in here. Five quick shots, the cops come up for air. Of a Spanish, still breathing while I walked away. And someone said, hey man, did you see that? His body hit the street with such a beautiful thud. Oh, wonder what that dude was saying, or was he just lost in the flood? Hey man, did you see that? Them cats are sure messed up. I wonder what they was getting into.
That's the end of side one. We'll flip the record and continue with side two on the next episode. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.
So, that's the show, folks. Thanks for listening. You can find us on our website at trampslikeuspod.com. Communicate with us on Facebook at our Tramps Like Us podcast group page. Tramps Like Us podcast is a nonprofit audio fanzine created by fans for fans and is available for free. We are not affiliated with Bruce Springsteen or Columbia Sony Records. If you've heard any music you like, please find it and purchase it from BruceSpringsteen.net, Amazon, your local record store, or wherever music is sold. As always, gratitude and respect to Bruce Springsteen and all past and current members of the heart-stopping, pants-dropping, hard-rocking, booty-shaking, earthquaking, love-making, Viagra-taking, history-making, testifying, death-defying, legendary E Street Band.
In case you just started listening, what you've been hearing is live music coming from Alpha Audio Recording Studios in Richmond. Bruce Springsteen and his band are here. They're going to be in concert tonight at the Coliseum with Chicago. And they decided to come down and give you a little preview. By the way, thanks for coming down. How long has it been since you've been in Richmond, Bruce?
When were we here? We were here about 8 months ago.
Well, I'm not from around here, but I understand you used to play here quite a bit.
Oh,
another band.
Yeah. You know, since about three years,
yeah.
You know, off and on.
How long have all of you been together?
Well, I've been with Gary for about a couple of years. Danny for, you know, 2 or 3 years. And Clarence is the newest cat, but Clarence is like an old shoe.
You got an old flute in your hand. What are you going to do with it?
Something I've seen.
Dueling flutes.
Are we ready? All right. Dueling flutes, right.
Feuding flutes.
Feuding flutes.